loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, sitting in for co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk about whether U.S.-EU relations are fraying and whether European countries are starting to move in the direction of Russia. We'll be talking with Peter Lavelle, the host of RT's flagship show, Crosstalk. And then we talk with Kevin Camps, as we do every Wednesday. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings at beyondnuclear.org. We talk about nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, nuclear waste, nuclear technology. We talk about all things nuclear. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Justice Department official Bruce Orr gave testimony and answered questions for 8 hours behind closed doors yesterday in a hearing held by the House Judiciary and House Oversight and Government Reform Committees. What does Orr's role in the investigation into alleged Russian collusion say about the nature of the entire Mueller investigation? Next, the governor of Puerto Rico commissioned a full study on the death toll from last year's Hurricane Maria, and the results have been released. Up from the original estimate of 64 fatalities, this week's report put the death toll at 2,975, making Maria one of the deadliest hurricanes ever. Then, with rumors swirling about President Trump potentially firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham appeared to throw his hat in the ring. Meanwhile, this morning, President Trump announced that White House counsel Don McGahn will be leaving in the fall. And then, important primaries were held across the country last night. In Florida, progressive Democratic candidate Andrew Gillum won the gubernatorial primary against frontrunner and former congressperson Gwen Graham. And his competitor, conservative Ron DeSantis, has been supported by Donald Trump. In Arizona, establishment favorite Martha McSally defeated two far-right challengers. And finally, teachers and faculty voted last night to approve a strike if negotiations with Seattle Public Schools don't produce a tentative contract by the start of the school year on Tuesday. And in other headlines, Canada has rejoined the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Mexico over the future of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The 24-year-old agreement has been the focus of intense negotiations for about a year, and Donald Trump has set Friday as the deadline to agree to revisions to the multilateral deal. Human rights activists and opposition parties in India expressed outrage today at the arrest of five high-profile activists. The arrested activists are accused of being members of the country's underground Maoist movement. The right-wing religious government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi is preparing for next year's election, and critics say the arrests are a move to cement his rule. Up to 13 Russian warships have headed towards Syria this week as tensions have risen in the country. The Russian Ministry of Defense said on Monday that the U.S. has been building up its military presence in the Middle East in a possible move to attack Syria. Insurgents from many different pockets across the country have been moved to Idlib as part of reconciliation agreements, and it's now widely expected that the Syrian army will launch a major offensive imminently. ICE agents have arrested 160 people in Texas who are employees of a trailer manufacturing plant. ICE declared a plan to increase 4 to 5-fold the number of workplace raids in 2018. The agency has been the target of nationwide protests that accuse it of racism and brutality. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Europe's relations with the United States and with Russia. French President Emmanuel Macron said this week that the European Union needs to look out for its own security rather than looking to the United States. Germany is moving forward with the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia against the U.S. demands. What does the strengthening of European and Russian relations and the fraying of U.S. and European relations mean for geopolitics? We're joined today from Moscow by Peter Lavelle. Peter is the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. Peter Lavelle, welcome back.
Great to be with you. I start back at work tomorrow, so this is a warm-up for me.
Okay, dress rehearsal. Got it. Peter, politics are happening pretty dynamically, we all have to admit, following the election of Donald Trump. Things seem to be sort of stuck in the mud in many ways. But since Trump's election, there's been such a big shakeup, both internally in terms of U.S. domestic politics, but certainly the deck of cards has been sort of reshuffled internationally as well. You have the French president saying Europe has to rely on itself, that it can't depend on the United States anymore. And Germany, in defiance of Trump's dictates, seems to be going forward with Nord Stream 2, allowing Germany to get cheaper gas from Russia. Anyway, what's your take on all of this?
Well, let's throw in the Germans have come out in the last couple of days of establishing their own Swiss system, banking clearance system, which is huge, absolutely huge. The power the United States has over its European allies and much of the world is financially. And to have a European Union figure come out and talking about an alternative to the American-controlled SWIFT system is saying a whole lot. The issue on energy, the U.S. State Department has made a lot of noise about it, but there's not much they can do. Germany and Russia are key to European and Russian energy security. There's no turning back on that. The more you try to push the Germans on it, the more the Germans are going to push back. The French, I think, Macron is trying, because he has a lot of domestic problems, but a Western leader doesn't. He's looking out more broadly. That means he's kind of in a stagnant moment in domestic politics. But I don't really think it's going to go anywhere. The Europeans have neutered themselves for decades. And it cuts a lot of different ways, and throw in Brexit. So what is European security going to be all about without the UK, which the UK is at the moment a prominent member of the European Union and a member of NATO? How NATO is going to play out after Brexit, we really don't know. We also know that the majority of Germans don't want to have American troops stationed on their soil any longer. Three quarters of a century after the Second World War, American troops are still there. A quarter of a century after the end of the Cold War. The interesting thing that is in play here is that the Europeans are showing their enormous weakness after being so dependent on the United States for so very long. And then you throw into the mix, the Trumpian mix here, is that Trump, in his heart of hearts, before the election and after the election, he doesn't really believe much in NATO. He doesn't believe that it works. He doesn't believe the United States actually should have to come to the aid of a member country if they were to find their security under attack or risk. And we could do a separate program looking at the NATO charter. It's not so cut and dry as the mainstream media wants to make it. So Trump says, fine, if NATO is going to be the game that we're all going to play, then you have to buy American arms. All right. So, you know, Trump actually wins out on it. I mean, he's really quite indifferent to NATO. But if he can get money for American arms manufacturers, why not? As a matter of fact, he's doing that all over the world. Embassies and consulates all around the world are drum up defense business for the United States. It's extraordinary. They're public about it as well. So this is the, you know, they're bringing the arms bazaar to openly to American diplomacy. Now, the other side of the coin is that for a country that is called isolated by Western media and punditry of the foreign policy blob, everybody wants to talk to Vladimir Putin these days. And he is quite willing to listen. He's made a number of trips to Europe recently, just in Turkey, a key situation being played out there for European security and NATO's future. And I think it all goes back, Brian and Walter, to the U.S. pulling out of the Iran deal. The Europeans are horrified by this. This is an indication that the United States, in their eyes, their great protector, quote unquote, is not a reliable partner, and it's really beginning to sink in. It's sinking in so deep that now they have to risk the wrath of the U.S. Treasury Department over sanctions of NATO allies. That's where we stand, gentlemen.
We're talking with Peter Lavelle. He is the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. Peter, let's stick with this topic of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The United States withdrew from the JCPOA, but Germany, France, the UK, even though the UK will be exiting the European Union, they're still signatories to it. They're still part of that deal. And corporations from those countries, for instance, Total and France, the oil corporation, since 2015, when the deal was signed, have made major investments in Iran, or were looking at making major investments in Iran. Talk about the efforts by those European countries to circumvent the quote-unquote secondary sanctions that the United States is planning on imposing on companies that do continue to do business with Iran.
Well, that I brought up earlier, the European's banking clearance system, SWIFT. I mean, that's one of the things they're thinking about seriously, because that's one way to get around the U.S. Treasury. And Total and these other companies know that if they continue their business in Iran, the United States might go after them in Argentina or Ecuador or Malaysia. Who knows? Okay. That's why they're afraid. It's not just the direct business in Iran. It's that they could be targeted elsewhere. That's why the European Union is eyeing to protect their companies, because they all know. It's so obvious that if their companies are forced to withdraw from Iran, China and Russia will pick up the void. Who knows? Maybe other countries as well. The United States is it's playing a game of chicken that it has there's very likely that they will lose. See, this is the game of threats and bluff. Now the Europeans are beginning to say, okay, call and show me your cards. Are you really going to go through it? And that's where we stand right now, because the European companies are positioning something. They all want some kind of free pass on an individual basis. And so far, the Treasury Department, through the direction of Trump and his people, and I think people like John Bolton primarily, are saying, no, let's go eye to eye with these folks here. This is a train wreck in the making, because the European Union their companies have extensive business operations around the world. So what they're afraid of is that the U.S. goes after them because of Iran, they could go down this path of, okay, because of your business there, we're going to sanction you elsewhere. That's the real trade war you have to worry about, because then it's not just inequality. I actually agree with Trump that, you know, a lot of trade deals should be redone, okay, because the original trade deals since the Second World War were for geopolitical reasons, not for economic reasons, meaning if you we'll accept a preferential trade agreement with you if you become part of the Imperium, you become part of the Western Alliance or the Western Washington Consensus. And that is all being overturned. And that's why so many people are so bewildered, because they, particularly the Europeans, they never could imagine that the hegemon would turn its back on them. And then the other implications here about what are the real defense and security needs of the European Union? Because if they're going to have to start paying a lot more for defense, what do you bet, gentlemen, that they'll suddenly realize, well, the Russian threat isn't as bad as we thought, because the Russian threat isn't there, and they don't want to have to build a military continent-wide apparatus to face a threat that doesn't really actually exist. And then you throw in the mix where you have the Baltic countries that may find one reason or another to get attention to their security needs, where we have two planes colliding in the air, a missile flying. Actually, they did lose a missile over the last couple of weeks. These are kind of the tripwires here. And so the Europeans are going to really have to a major rethink. You said if they want to have to, don't want to have to, they don't want to spend this money because they know there isn't a threat, then they're going to say to the United States, then yes, we should reconsider what NATO means. Then you have the entire post-war order turned on its head.
That's the voice of Peter Lavelle. Peter is the host of the flagship show Crosstalk on RT Television. We're talking to him about the very profound dynamic change in geopolitics and perhaps on economics, which go together between the United States and Europe, between Europe and Russia, potentially. Peter, I'm picking up on your last point that over time, and perhaps we're just looking at a series of, I don't know, unintended consequences, the law of unintended consequences. I don't know if there is a law, but let's give it that name. You know, the U.S. is trying to do one thing, but in effect, by shifting up or switching out of the multilateral trade agreements that were created after World War II and the other multilateral institutions after World War II, whereby the United States allies and its adversaries, Germany and Japan, were all sort of brought together as junior partners of the United States with the idea that, unlike Germany after World War I, which was sort of snuffed out with Versailles Treaty sanctions and punishments, the U.S. would rehabilitate all, help build up all, give all access to certain parts of the world market in exchange for the political quid pro quo that they would be part of the U.S. sort of imperium, as you said. It was part of the anti-Soviet Cold War alliance. Now it's being undone. And I want to go to what Macron said yesterday. He stressed the need to engage with Russia and Turkey on multiple issues, saying, quote, "The history of these peoples is made with Europe. We must accept that there will be a large Europe, larger than even the European Union." And at the same time, the German government is signaling that the lira, the Turkish lira, which has been sort of tanking as a consequence of the spat with the U.S. government, that Germany is now contemplating a bailout for Turkey. So here, Russia and Turkey, also part of Europe. It's exactly along the lines of what you're suggesting.
Well, it's exactly what, and I'm not a big fan of the person, it's exactly what Mikhail Gorbachev said as the Cold War was winding down. It's remarkable. You had, when Putin first became president, he talked about a Europe from Lisbon to Vladivostok. We had his successor, Dmitry Medvedev, saying the same thing. It's remarkable, almost the same kind of paradigm here. The thing is that when you look at Russia and Turkey, you know, Macron, I think, maybe is acting in good faith here, but Turkey is flexing its muscles. It's coming. It's becoming what it into being what it really is. It is a regional superpower. And if you like Erdogan or not, if you like or dislike Turkish foreign policy, for example, vis-a-vis Syria, all I can say is get used to it, because they can do what they do. Now, Russia, after being treated so shabbily, particularly over the last decade or so, Russia, it's basically saying, we've got options too. Now, if you want to deal in good faith, you have to listen to our concerns as well. We have concerns, legitimate national security concerns. And if you're not willing to listen in good faith, then what's the point of having a conversation? You know, the Turks already know they're never going to be part of the European Union. Now, let that go, all right? And they should have never been promised it in the first place. And Turkey, look at what it's done over the last few years. What kind of relationship does it have with Russia? It's had its ups and downs, but now it's smoothing out. Look at its relationship with Iran. Turkey's going to balk at the United States when it comes to Iran. It's very, very clear. Turkey has very clear foreign policy aims, not that I would necessarily agree with them, vis-a-vis Syria. And there's nothing the U.S. can do about it anymore, not to speak of Emmanuel Macron. So this is the sea change that we're seeing right now. The Europeans and the Americans still think they're at the center of the world. Well, I'll tell you, the world is changing. Just last week or so, 10 days ago, the Caspian Sea negotiations came to a rough conclusion, a consensus. That is such huge news when it comes to the energy markets and to regional stability. But I bet you no one over at MSNBC and CNN had even heard about it. That's what I'm getting at. The world is changing so quickly. And the Europeans and the Americans are very focused on very, and sometimes I think very trivial issues. Because so much is happening in the world right now, they have less and less impact and influence on. So I'm not surprised that people are coming to visit Vladimir Putin, because the old way of doing business is coming to an end. The new way of doing business, well, we don't know yet.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Peter Lavelle. He's the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. We're talking about one of the big dynamics in geopolitics today. That's the fraying of relations between the United States and the European Union, and what might be a warming of relations between the European countries and Russia. Peter, you know, like we were saying, the origins of the bloc between Europe and the United States can be traced back to the Cold War and anti-Soviet alliance. But even during that period, I mean, it wasn't a perfect alliance, right? You had German Chancellor Willy Brandt initiating the Ostpolitik policy, where he would warm relations with both East Germany and the Soviet bloc in general. You had de Gaulle in France briefly pulling France out of the NATO military alliance. So if there was a warming of relations between Europe and Russia to the detriment of relations with the United States, it wouldn't actually be historically unprecedented, right?
Well, it might be unprecedented. It's not unprecedented, but it could be like what Peter is suggesting. Peter, I think, is you're saying that all took place with those bumps that Walter is mentioning, those dislocations. The world order was very secure. I mean, you had GATT, you had the UN, you had the IMF, you had the World Bank, all U.S.-led institutions. The GATT evolved into the World Trade Organization. Even if there was some sort of annoyance from some of the allies, they were still, you know, you could see that they were all on the same trajectory. I'm wondering, Peter, you're saying the old order is, in fact, perhaps coming undone. It doesn't come undone all at once. It's kind of an important point because the new world order, so-called, that the U.S. sort of geostrategic thinkers masterminded between 1943 and 45 was also not simply to maintain U.S. dominance and U.S. hegemony, but actually to prevent another outbreak of war between major powers that led first to World War I in 1914, and then 20 years after it ended, again, World War II. I mean, the spasm of sort of imperial rivalry that led to war after war that was decimating the existing world order. Anyway, I think it's a big story.
Yeah, but I think to kind of address what Walter just said here, I agree. And when you said, Walter, and you know history well, and I compliment you because so few people do these days. But the difference in this case, the bump is different. Because it's a chasm that's being approached right now. It's the U.S. that is having serious second thoughts about what its role is in the international order. And I think that that's what Trump's America First is about. He's not a nativist, not by any stretch of the imagination. He's not an isolationist either. But what he wants to go it more alone. He doesn't want people piggybacking on the back of the United States. Now, we could have a long argument, discussion, how that would work or not work, but that's essentially what he is saying. And does that make the world a safer place? I don't think so. But because what the United States should be doing, it should be embracing a dialogue with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the Indians. I mean, outside of the Western-centric world, these countries are playing a growing key role in the regions where they are. Now, the United States, vis-a-vis Europe, the Europeans can't comprehend what Donald Trump is trying to do. And that's what makes this really kind of a world historic moment. The United States isn't leaving the world. It's just dealing with the world in a different way. And I think that's what really puzzles the Europeans, actually puzzles me too, because I don't exactly know what the end game is.
Yeah, Peter, let me jump in. I think we're on to, these are extremely important topics. And none of us have a crystal ball, so we don't know where it ends. But with that said, is this Trump, this kind of unique figure in American politics who intervened, came in sort of outside the existing establishment, doing things his own way, strong leadership, and sort of defying a lot of the consensus of positions? Or does he represent a deeper current within the establishment? Because let's say Donald Trump was no longer president, either because he didn't win re-election or because something happened to him in terms of this legal assault that is being waged by other parts of the establishment who are very much wedded to the existing international order and see in Trump a threat to that order. In other words, is it momentary? Is it a personality? Or does Trump represent something else? Or has he catalyzed something else?
I think you asked probably the most important question. And it's such an excellent question. My answer is going to be less than excellent because I really don't know. Brian, I've pondered this quite a bit recently because, and with my small circle around me, we've argued and bantered about this. I tend to think there is a paradigm shift, a real paradigm shift happening. Not everyone agrees with me thinking they could go back to business as usual the day he's impeached or he resigns or is not reelected. I think there's the paradigm shift is that what is the cost of empire? And this is where there is a difference between the elites and everybody else. Empire is really good for the elites in the West, very good. But it's not paying dividends. Look at the European Union, and it's analogous with the United States. The European Union, their fundamental promise to have union is we'll make you rich and we'll keep you safe. Well, they're not keeping them rich, and they're less and less safe. The American electorate, at least a good portion, 50% or so, feel exactly the same way. Business as usual is not prosperous for them, and it's not keeping them safe. And so this is where the big change is. Is Donald Trump tapped into something that's going to take off, have an organic growth itself, or is he just this amazing world historic figure that comes and leaves our lives? I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah. Well, Walter, we have 1 minute left. You want to venture a 10-second guess? Look, if Trump's gone, this isn't 10 seconds. Predict the future right now.
If Trump's gone, I think there is enough of a consensus, and I think that the old establishment is strong enough that they would be able to reassert the trajectory, their traditional trajectory.
No, Walter, we do this next week, okay? Give me a call.
I think you're being invited onto Crosstalk.
I would be honored.
Okay, we'll get you on for sure.
We're going to leave it there. We were joined today from Moscow by Peter Lavelle. Peter is the host of RT's flagship program, Crosstalk. It's broadcast 3 times a week. Is that right, Peter?
Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
It's Wednesday, so we continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and learn about the group and get involved with the group by going to their website at beyondnuclear.org. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. Nicole, Kevin Camps, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Kevin, there's, again, as there is every week, some really, really big stories. Where do you want to start?
Well, I've been up to my eyeballs in radioactive waste, so to speak.
Sounds dangerous.
Yes, story of my life. So not only are we going to be facing a mega fight in New Mexico, we just learned a few days ago that the waste control specialist dump in Texas is also resuming its license application proceedings. So now we're going to have 2 mega dump fights just 40 miles from each other in New Mexico and Texas at the same time.
Man, that is quite a lot. So in one of these is including Holtec, is that right?
Yeah, Holtec International has proposed a centralized interim storage facility in southeastern New Mexico for 173,000 metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel. That's twice as much as exists in the United States right now. And then waste control specialists just 40 miles away from Holtec in Texas, which is already a national so-called low-level radioactive waste dump, wants to get into the high-level radioactive waste interim storage business, and they're proposing another 40,000 metric tons. So you add it all up, it's 213,000 metric tons, and there's only, within quotation marks, only 81,000 metric tons in the United States right now.
I mean, I don't even understand how big a metric ton is. That just sounds like a massive amount of extremely dangerous waste.
Yeah, the United States has 100 operating reactors. It used to have 125. There's only, again in quotes, only 450 reactors in the entire world. So you can see the U.S. is 20 to 25% of the high-level radioactive waste in the entire world. And what these companies are up to is anybody's guess. I mean, there wouldn't be that much if all the reactors operating now operated out their entire 60 years. It used to only be 40 years, but they're pushing the safety margins by 20 years. And just today, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has announced that they're oh so happy to undertake a review of a proposal for 80 years of operations at the Peach Bottom reactors in Pennsylvania, just under 100 miles from Washington, D.C., on the Maryland-Pennsylvania line. And those are Fukushima twins. So maybe that's what's going on, is they're planning to operate reactors for 80 years. There's even rumors of 100 years out there.
That sounds incredibly dangerous. Like, don't these reactors have kind of a life to them? Don't they need to be shut down earlier than that?
Yeah, it's called the breakdown phase of atomic reactors. It also applies to toasters. It's just an engineering concept that the longer you operate an engineered system, a mechanical system, it's going to break. The parts are going to age, they're going to break. And so as you age these reactors, the risk of accidents increases significantly. And the question is, you know, what shape is that going to take? Is it going to be a meltdown? Will the containment hold? And, you know, there's a cautionary tale from Fukushima Daiichi in Japan. Unit number one, the first to melt down, had just gotten a license extension a month earlier. It should not even have been operating. It was 40 years old. It should have shut down permanently. And the Japanese government, following the lead of the U.S. government, gave it a license extension. And that was meltdown number one, which was the first domino that led to meltdowns two and three. So there's a cautionary tale there about license extension.
That's absolutely a cautionary tale. And I like your comparison to toasters because, you know, sometimes you buy an old toaster off of Craigslist, which I did a couple of years ago, and you can see some of the little filaments in there just, you know, breaking off. You can see them glowing red. That's not things that you necessarily want to be in a much bigger format like a nuclear reactor and with much, much, much more dangerous material. You're right. Things just break down.
Yeah. And Kevin, this is really all about profit, right? I mean, the reason why you would extend the lifetime of a nuclear reactor, something that's so extremely dangerous beyond what, you know, the normal functionality of the engineered system, like you were saying. I mean, that's just about money. It's because it's expensive to fix these things.
Yeah. And, you know, a funny part of the toaster and atomic reactor comparison is the companies involved are ones like General Electric, which make both, you know, and Westinghouse. And, there's engineered obsolescence is a part of this. And Walter, you're onto something significant there. The nuclear power industry seems to be mostly about just making money. And the whole nuclear electricity thing is kind of an afterthought. And yeah, they do make a lot of electricity, but their main goal is just making a lot of money. And, you know, another example of this involves Holtec again. Just in recent weeks now, they've announced a whole new division of Holtec. It's decommissioning. This is when atomic reactors close and the facilities are dismantled. The radioactive materials and contamination are supposed to be cleaned up and shipped off to a radioactive waste dump like Waste Control Specialists, which is a national low-level radioactive waste dump. And so, again, the money-making motivation as opposed to the, you know, let's clean up radioactive waste motivation, they're really the open secret is they're after the decommissioning trust funds. And the first case of this is going to be Oyster Creek, New Jersey, another Fukushima Daiichi twin, just like Peach Bottom in Pennsylvania. So Oyster Creek is 49 years old in September. It's going to close next month, which is wonderful news because when you close a reactor and take the irradiated fuel out of the core, it can't have a meltdown. But what is Holtec going to do there? They are after the $1 billion decommissioning trust fund at Oyster Creek that's supposed to be there for cleanup of the radioactive contamination. They're going to do as little cleanup as they can get away with, and they're going to try to pocket the rest of the money. That's what's going on. And then they're going to try to race the irradiated nuclear fuel down to New Mexico as quickly as they can get away with, which increases all associated risk.
This is yet another money-making scheme, like you said, but we've heard so many in the nuclear field. And, you know, Holtec, we've talked a bunch about on the show as being, I mean, a lot of these companies, maybe all of these companies are often cutting costs and doing whatever they need to make as much money as possible. But Holtec in particular, you know, we've talked a lot about. And Kevin, there was a recent revelation by a whistleblower about Holtec. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they've got a similar design for the New Mexico dump in Southern California. It's called San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant, and they were contracted to provide the high-level radioactive waste management and on-site storage there, and showing their true colors, Holtex and Southern California Edison. They put this dry cast storage installation right on the edge of the Pacific Ocean, within like 100 feet of the water. And it is subgrade, so you can't see the containers holding the high-level radioactive waste, but they've brought it that close to the tsunami zone, that close to the earthquake fault lines in the Pacific, and rising sea levels over time. And what happened was there was a public meeting. There's a citizens advisory board about this very controversial storage site for high-level radioactive waste, and a whistleblower spoke out at the proceeding, somebody who had worked on the loading project for the high-level radioactive waste storage. And what he said was, I promised my 12-year-old daughter, who's sitting in the audience, that if this issue was not brought up tonight, I would bring it up because it needs to be brought up. And what he brought up, and he said, this is going to cost me my job. I'm not sure if he's lost his job yet or not, but they had nearly dropped a fully loaded container of high-level radioactive waste. And it's a very serious thing because you can damage the irradiated nuclear fuel itself, or you could damage its container. And if you do both at the same time, you're going to have a release of radioactivity. And this is high-level radioactive waste. Certainly workers could be killed because they're so close to it. And that container is the radiation shielding. And this stuff will kill you within seconds or minutes. It just depends on how long it's been out of the reactor core. That's without even touching it. That's just at short-range distance. The gamma radiation and neutron radiation can deliver a fatal dose in a very short period of time.
Yeah, how would emergency responders even react to that? I mean, do people have the necessary training? Are local governments prepared to deal with a spill of nuclear waste?
Well, listening to the fire chiefs and their public relations people, you know, they're trained to, you know, calm people down and be confident. But truth be told, how can you train for something like that? I mean, they would do their best, I'm sure. But one of the things I've heard, and this is in the context of the Yucca Mountain dump in Nevada, you know, the transports from a place like the East Coast, those are thousands of miles. There are countless jurisdictions in between. Most of those are volunteer fire departments. And if they're the ones called upon to deal with a radiological release in transport, there's this joke called the rule of thumb that if you can't cover the accident scene with your thumb, if you're not that far enough away, you better get that far enough away until you're sure there's no radioactivity releases, because otherwise you could be injured or killed in a very short period of time. So, and in the case of the Holtec proposal, I mean, the Yucca Mountain proposal was a Department of Energy proposal, federal government. There was money for training and equipment. It was woefully inadequate. It was really a token measure in some cases. But at Holtec, they haven't even bothered with that. So they're just going to depend on, you know, the volunteer fire department at the Kansas Potawatomi Indian Reservation to deal with a rail disaster involving this deadly material.
Yet another way that they are taking advantage of and exploiting workers in the region. We're joined from Michigan right now by Kevin Camps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear, and he joins us every Wednesday to give us some updates about what's going on in the world of nuclear weapons, energy, waste, and technology. Kevin, I wanted to also talk about the order isn't new. The order is from the Department of Energy back in May, but the Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board has been convening hearings about this order, and I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about this. This is to do with worker protection in these nuclear facilities.
Well, this is a pretty extreme dastardly deed by the Trump administration, by Energy Secretary Rick Perry, to essentially try to gut the Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board. And I have to wonder if it's because of this just incredible series of exposés a year ago now that appeared in various places. Journalists, many times, thanks to revelations brought to light by the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board, uncovered just major incidents that had occurred recently, in recent years even, at places like Los Alamos and Idaho National Lab. You name the nuclear weapons complex site, and just incredible things have happened where workers were nearly killed by inadvertent nuclear criticality events. And a lot of times it was for the stupidest of reasons, like at Los Alamos, workers were so proud of their purification of plutonium and fabrication of it into fuel elements for weapons purposes that they wanted to take a picture. They wanted to take a selfie. And they lined up all their work together and took a selfie, so to speak, of their work. And they nearly caused a nuclear chain reaction by bringing that much plutonium, that pure, that close together. And the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board and then journalists brought this to public attention. And so now they want to gut it. And it would be a critical blow because this agency has access to these sites. These are super secretive sites, right? And if the Department of Energy wants to keep secrets, they could easily do so. But if you have a transparency agency whose mission is protect public safety and health, and oh, by the way, workers too, and that's the part that Rick Perry is trying to take away, their legal trick here is if it doesn't have to do with public health and safety, if it's only worker health and safety, well, the Defense Nuclear Safety Board shouldn't be involved. And the board itself, to its credit, just now at Los Alamos, as revealed in a Los Alamos study group press release yesterday, really came out swinging. And, you know, that's how public servants should behave. They should defend their public interest mandate. And, you know, we ourselves at Beyond Nuclear and our allies have benefited directly from the Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board in terms of liquid high-level radioactive waste shipments from Canada to South Carolina. And we learned of incidents in South Carolina and in Canada, in fact, that we would not have learned of only because of this government agency bringing it to light.
Yeah, it's hard to get more evil, really more evil than what Rick Perry and what the Trump administration is doing on this. I mean, and metaphorically playing with fire. Is it really all just about profit, or is it part of this, the deregulation ideological element to it? Well, anyway, just answer that.
Yeah, I think both of those are flip sides of the same coin, actually. And there's an added element here in that, and Greg Mello pointed this out in his press release. This is a nuclear weapons production agenda. In a sense, it's like stepping back to the 1950s and 60s. Safety be damned, we have nuclear weapons to produce here. And they want to make new ones at Los Alamos. They want to do the uranium work at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Get out of our way with all these safety regulations. And the thing is, of course, worker safety leads directly to public safety. If they have an inadvertent nuclear chain reaction at Los Alamos, which is where that almost happened, what could happen? If, you know, there could be a consequent fire. The fire could burn the place down and burn all the plutonium up. And once the plutonium hitches a ride on the smoke, it's going to blow, you know, countless miles downwind. And, you know, people live out there. There's Native American reservations surrounding Los Alamos. So I don't know what they're talking about with that disconnect. It of course, makes no sense.
Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group has made some really important comments. And I just want to read from that press release. He said, you know, the Trump administration, they want to drive a wedge between public health and worker health, isolating the latter both literally and figuratively. But protecting worker safety has always been a major emphasis of the board, in part because public health and safety, the main focus of the board's mandate, cannot be protected without protecting workers. He goes on to say, we believe the board should be well advised to make it clear to Congress, which created the board in 1988, that under the terms of this order, the board will be unable to protect DOE energy defense workers from nuclear hazards. At a minimum, Congress should expand the mandate to explicitly advise DOE on worker safety and health at all defense nuclear facilities in parallel to their explicit public safety and health mandate. We call upon the New Mexico congressional delegation to lead the charge on this. I mean, I think that's definitely right. An expansion of these protections makes so much more sense and is so important rather than what they're doing, which is gutting it.
I mean, I think back to some of the, you know, most dramatic, I guess, nuclear weapons production disasters in U.S. history. One would have been a major fire at Rocky Flats, Colorado. They had a big one in 1957. I think the other one was in 1969, perhaps, where they had a massive fire at the production facility in Boulder, Colorado. And right downwind is Denver, Colorado. And, you know, when plutonium is burning, it's going to blow with the wind. And unfortunately, it's very windy out there, too. So, you know, if the workers had been better protected, then there probably wouldn't have been a fire and there wouldn't have been a massive plutonium release into the environment upwind of Denver. And, you know, that haunts us to this day. A federal judge, incredibly, just ruled recently that, yes, indeed, the Rocky Mountains, the Rocky Flats National Wildlife Refuge can open to the public. Buses of school children can be taken out there, never mind the plutonium that's still lingering in the soil. And, you know, credit to the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. They are trying to warn people, do not visit this wildlife refuge. It's dangerous to go there. There's plutonium out there.
And it also seems like I just wanted to see if you think this is right, Kevin. The Los Alamos Study Group is also connecting this specific order to the nuclear posture review a little bit. Again, this is Greg Mello quoting from Greg Mello. There's no question that the present order was drafted in order to remove the DNFSB. This is the board we're talking about, as an obstacle to Trump administration plans to jumpstart nuclear weapons production, particularly the construction of new facilities for production of plutonium nuclear warhead cores. So these are the, you know, the really basic parts of nuclear weapons. Do you think that's right? Do you think this is totally connected to that?
Yeah, and at Los Alamos specifically, and Greg did a great job in the press release pointing this out, the facility being proposed for production of new plutonium pits for weapons is not safe enough for this kind of work. It would take a much safer facility, and the Trump administration apparently doesn't want to invest that kind of money, so they're just going to get rid of the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board and carry on forward with this very dangerous plan. So it's kind of, you know, a recipe for disaster.
I mean, look, I agree that we shouldn't invest this kind of money in new nuclear weapons. Had they thought about just not making new ones, do you think?
Well, you know, that's the thing where Trump just took the baton from the Obama administration to carry on this now, as you adjust for inflation, $1.7 trillion nuclear modernization and upgrade program. So, unfortunately, the Obama administration blessed it, and now the Trump administration is racing forward with gusto.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point because, you know, proponents of nuclear energy and the nuclear power industry or even nuclear weapons will probably cite, you know, the number of jobs that are tied up in the industry in one way or another, and then those workers' families and so on and so on. But the resources are there. It's absolutely there to retrain workers to make sure that they can still make a decent wage, have a good job, have a better job. I mean, that's where the money is, right? This $1.7 trillion investment into upgrading the U.S. nuclear arsenal and so many other things that the Pentagon does. I mean, it's just a myth, right, to say that the resources aren't there to retrain and redirect workers away from this industry.
There have been long calls for just transitions of places like Los Alamos even. You know, if your concern is the workers, as you just said, well, how about we devote this institution, this place to renewable energy instead of nuclear weapons? And kind of a funny story, I toured Los Alamos National Lab as part of Alliance for Nuclear Accountability a couple years ago. And the funny part about the tour in such a dark place was that as we were, you know, toured around by the Department of Energy and you listen to their spiel, they do all kinds of great stuff out there. They work on renewable energy. They work on automobile efficiency. They work on materials durability. And it's all good, you know? And the official tour that we took, you wouldn't know they worked on nuclear weapons there because they didn't mention it. Except we saw all the signs for, you know, lethal force authorized if you enter this gate without permission kind of thing. So how about we retire the nuclear weapons arsenal and dismantle it and abolish it once and for all and redevote all those resources? And again, you know, something like $10 trillion has been spent by the United States on nuclear weapons in the past several decades, and redirect the $1.7 trillion that would go into a renovation of nuclear weapons into renewable energy and into, you know, cleanup of the radioactive messes we've made across our country since 1942.
Kevin, I think that's a novel idea. I think we should do it.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of folks have worked hard, including folks at Los Alamos, you know, Los Alamos Study Group and Nuclear Watch New Mexico and so many groups just in New Mexico itself. Let's transition this place and turn this history around because it is a dark history in New Mexico. And then, you know, the other side's vision is let's keep going with it. Let's turn southeastern New Mexico into a national sacrifice area for the nuclear power industry. And because we might not have enough room at the one site, let's do it in Texas too, 40 miles away. So those are the competing visions, and the fight is on.
Yeah, that's definitely where it seems to be headed, save for all of the really important work that the Los Alamos Study Group is doing, that Beyond Nuclear is doing, that, you know, the really large, powerful, important group of voices all around the country of people, of organizations who are pushing back. You know, there's also, I think, Kevin, a couple of new reactors that they're talking about in Georgia and Florida as well. Is that still on track? What's going on with that?
Well, you know, the only reactors that are actually supposedly under construction are in Georgia. Georgia has Vogtle units 3 and 4 new build. It's going really badly. And so badly that a sister project in South Carolina canceled a year ago at a loss of $9 billion, with a B, to South Carolina ratepayers. But the case with the Georgia reactors is not only ratepayer money, many billions of dollars, probably equivalent to the South Carolina $9 billion or so, but also U.S. taxpayer nuclear loan guarantees in the amount of $12 billion. And the Florida connection is that it's such a big new build that even Florida utilities had got in on the action when the project sounded like a good idea 10 years ago. And one of them is Jacksonville, Florida Electric. They want out now. That's the amazing thing. They could be the first domino that leads to other defections from this project. And chances are actually good, I guess you could say, that this project is going to default. And it'll be a financial collapse, just like in South Carolina a year ago. And what that would mean is all of those billions of ratepayer dollars would be wasted, and $12 billion of U.S. taxpayer money in the form of nuclear loan guarantees would go up in smoke. And that happens to be 22 times the amount lost at the Solyndra Solar loan guarantee default that Republicans tried to make so much hay about 10 years ago and hang around Obama's neck, even though George W. Bush had initiated that solar loan guarantee. So it's just amazing, the hypocrisy, because not a peep is being made in the Republican Congress about the risk at Vogtle Nuclear right now of $12 billion of taxpayer money being lost.
That's right. I remember Solyndra was they made a huge deal about Solyndra, 22 times Solyndra. That's quite.
Yep.
When you look at the Wall Street Journal, they did a piece on this a couple of weeks ago. Southern Company earnings hurt by cost overruns at nuclear power plant. Cost to build the Vogtle plant increase again by more than $1 billion. And again, you know, what the headline infers is that the problem is earnings, meaning investor monies that might be earned as a consequence of earnings or profit could be impacted. It's not all about at all that the taxpayers are the one actually footing the bill should this go belly up.
Yeah, the scandal at Vogtle 3 and 4 is that the companies like Southern Nuclear and their shareholders have no skin in the game, $0 and 0 cents. It's all ratepayer money on their electric bills. They are unwitting many times and unwilling many times shareholders in this thing. They're not going to get any returns on their investment, though, and even if it goes forward. And, you know, just thanks for the free loan you gave us, essentially. And then the other, you know, unwilling and unwitting investor in this project is the American taxpayer to the tune of $12 billion. And it's all at major risk right now. The only silver lining, if this house of cards comes tumbling down, is it would never operate. It would never go radioactive. There could not be a meltdown, and it would never make any radioactive waste. Those are the silver linings. But the money would be lost and probably will be lost, truth be told.
One thing that you mentioned, Kevin, about the Georgia legislature that decided to go ahead and go through with these Vogtle 3 and 4 new builds, they thought it was a good idea. It's just kind of astounding to me that companies and the legislature all kind of decided that this was a good idea. There is such a long history that we've heard about from you on the show of some of these projects just totally either going under or being just exorbitantly expensive and never really making any money for people. Is that right? Am I getting that right? Or what on earth, you know, made them decide to go ahead and do this?
atomic amnesia and remember, you know, it's other people's money. And so somebody is making $9 billion spent in South Carolina. So, you know, the companies involved are loving it. They're eating it up. Their CEOs are making killer salaries. The shareholders are loving the returns. It's all at the public's risk. And so, you know, shame on, of course, the state legislatures and shame on the Public Service Commission. And, you know, in this crazy country of ours, what happens when the chairman of the South Carolina Public Service Commission gets, you know, embroiled in a $9 billion loss to the citizens of South Carolina? He gets promoted. He gets promoted by President Trump to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. David Wright is now an NRC commissioner after this financial disaster that he helped create in South Carolina with nuclear new build. So now he's in charge of nuclear safety at the national level.
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Michigan by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and get involved with the group by going to the website beyondnuclear.org. And we've also been joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Roussel. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.